Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. As you know, on this programme we will address the most important issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organisations, communities and most importantly, the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So, stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss the simmering political crisis in Pakistan with former Premier Imran Khan announcing his anti-government and anti-army campaign. And we shall also look at how the construction of hydropower dams in Indian-administered Kashmir has put the environment and local communities at risk.
Pakistan continues to lurch from one crisis to another. Former Prime Minister Imran Khan, who was unceremoniously ousted earlier this year, has stepped up his fight against his political rivals and the powerful army. The power struggle in a country grappling with a grave economic crisis may alter the political paradigm, especially with Pakistan's top election body disqualifying the former premier from holding office for 5 years. Whether he will prevail in this battle or meet the fate of his predecessors remains to be seen.
Since April, when cricketer-turned-politician and former Premier Imran Khan was removed from office through a parliamentary no-confidence vote, the political environment in Pakistan has been highly charged. Khan has accused the Pakistan Muslim League government led by Prime Minister Shahbaz Sharif of conspiring with the country's powerful army and the United States to oust him. There have been massive political rallies across Pakistan in recent months organized by his supporters, while the PML government has launched a serious crackdown on Khan and his party leaders. Last month, Pakistan's top election body disqualified Khan from holding a public office for 5 years, accusing him of selling gifts he received from foreign dignitaries as prime minister. The populist leader termed the decision a politically motivated move to sideline him. The ruling could render him ineligible to run in Pakistan's next general elections. Amidst these developments, a prominent Pakistani journalist considered close to Khan was killed in mysterious circumstances in Kenya. He had fallen out with the country's military after Khan was removed from office, which has prompted many to link his murder to the military. All eyes are now on the so-called Long March Imran Khan has launched to demand early elections when it reaches the capital, Islamabad.
In the short order which we have received till now, the Imran Khan has been disqualified for the time being. Now it is up to him to file appeal before the Honorable Supreme Court, and the main decision will again come from the Supreme Court that for which term he is disqualified. So it will be seen at later on stage.
The looming uncertainty over Imran Khan's political fate and the much-anticipated change of guard in the military next month has put the South Asian country on the edge. Political instability is accompanied by worsening social and economic outlook. Pakistan's economy continues to be under stress amid downgraded ratings, devalued bonds, depleting foreign reserves and millions of people in need of assistance following the recent devastating floods. Combined with political volatility, the country appears to be struggling to stay afloat.
The latest political upheaval in Pakistan comes amid a deeply volatile and polarized political atmosphere. This is the country where no elected prime minister has managed to complete a full term in office. Imran Khan says the only way to halt his anti-government campaign is to hold early elections.
The Election Commission is a biased organization, as we all know. They are manipulating all these affairs. They are doing it in a way that actually created chaos in Pakistan politics. So I believe that this decision will create only a chaos in Pakistan politics, not more than that.
Last week, in the first press conference ever by the country's intelligence chief, Nadeem Anjum accused Khan of seeking to foment anarchy in the country. He responded to sharp attacks on the military by Khan in recent weeks, including references to Army Chief General Kamar Bajwa as traitor. Bajwa is set to step down next month with all eyes on his yet-to-be-appointed successor.
The disqualification is actually under Article 63.1b. It's for the time being disqualified. He is disqualified from the National Assembly. He is disqualified for the Provincial Assembly. He cannot be elected at this time because he is disqualified under this decision of the Election Commission.
The political crisis in Pakistan is combined with a fledgling economy amid warnings from rating agencies that it must take hard decisions to avoid economic default. Global rating agency Fitch recently cut the country's sovereign credit rating from B to CCC+, citing a drop in its liquidity and foreign reserves. Noted economist Steve Hank says the government has failed to save the sinking ship. This is while the country is still trying to recover from the devastating floods that wreaked havoc across the country recently, displacing millions of people.
Now to have more insight on this, we are joined by Mr. Malik Ayub Sumbal, a political analyst from Islamabad. Mr. Sumbal, welcome to the program. Now, Pakistan is grappling today with both political and economic crisis as former Premier Imran Khan fights for his survival amid crackdown from the government and also the military. So the question is, where is the country headed?
I think, unfortunately, Pakistan is in the very bad days. If we recall our memories and if we can go back in 1971, I think that the same time, the same political deadlock witnessed at that time in which we have lost East Pakistan. So unfortunately, again, we are at the same crossroad. And ultimately here, unfortunately, I would say that it's not the public interest, but it's the interest of the politician, their vested interest, and whatever they want, that everybody wants into power. So this is actually the tragedy and the dilemma right now. That's keep Pakistan politician at a very crossroad under the current circumstances, if we see.
So do you think Imran Khan's demand for early elections will be accepted with the Shahbaz or by the Shahbaz Sharif government? And what are his party's chances in the next general elections?
So to accept the demand of the early election is not only on the will or on the decision of the Shahbaz Sharif, because he is actually the nominated and the elected prime minister of the PDM, Pakistan Democratic Movement, which is the major alliance of all the political parties. So it's not on the discretion or the decision of the Shahbaz Sharif, but to all the other stakeholders who are involved in this PDM, who are the part of the government right now. So will his demands will be accepted? So I think that will tell us his protest, that how much people he can take out during his power show, that he's going to be, because it's going to be something like very decisive moment, that if Imran Khan will not bring such a mass population, which he is claiming through his various processions and demonstration. So then that will be a very downfall for all his recent boom that was seen in the recent weeks, in which I can say that one of the tactics to blackmail the military establishment and the current government. So it's not only the decision of the prime minister, but the other stakeholders who are currently the part of the government.
Sir, in Pakistan, the military has always had the final word and no political leader has managed to challenge the military authority. Now, do you think Khan will buck the trend or meet the fate of his predecessors?
I don't think so, that Imran Khan has challenged the military, actually, in reality, because this is actually the military for which he has been taken into the power. This is the military, and now he has only the demand of like a stubborn child who is demanding that take me back into the power. So it's not like they're challenging the military or the military establishment, but he is giving an impression inside the country that I am fighting for the status quo and for the people who are at the very low level, who are at the very grassroots level. So he is trying to exploit all those sentiments and the people that I am going to fight you. I am going to fight for you people. And I am going to tell you that the country should have the rule of the law. There should be parliament supremacy. There should be the supremacy of the constitution. But actually, Imran Khan has double standards. He is playing on two different fields. First, he is playing with the people of the Pakistan, actually, who are his fan clubs, majority of them, because they did not understand the actually the true essence of the Pakistani politics. And simultaneously, he is engaged into the dialogue and the talks with the military that they should take him back into the power. They should give him to another opportunity to serve the country. And simultaneously, he is also the pawn and the puppet of the international establishment, because there are a lot of gossips and there are a lot of the hair and saying that Imran Khan, that currently, right now, the country who is facing such kind of the severe challenges at this time, he is not colliding with the current government, but actually he is colliding with the state and an institution of the Pakistan. He is trying to make an impression that there is a clash of the institution, and simultaneously he wants to drive the country into the very, very unprecedented and very violent situation. That is, of course, the civil war.
Last but not least, the country is in dire economic straits with soaring inflation and depleting foreign reserves. So what do you think is the panacea for Pakistan's unending economic woes?
I think the Pakistan's current economic solution is only into the stable political situation. If the country situation would be stable and it will be move on, I think that the country would like to back on their reserves and all those the economic challenges which the country is facing. And unfortunately, this is exactly the country is facing, because in the last 3 years, when Imran Khan was as the prime minister, there was the mega embezzlements and there was the huge losses at the diplomatic front, economic front, and all even the strategical partner of Pakistan, in which Pakistan faced huge losses. And this is the credit goes to Imran Khan, which he is trying to now proving to the people of the Pakistan that I am your well-wisher and I am trying to take this country back from all these challenges. So I think that the only economic solution and the stability is possible, and the country will be have the stable political transition, and it should go like this.
There you have it, Mr. Sumbal, political analyst from Islamabad. Thank you for being on the program, sir. Now let's see how people have reacted on social media.
CJ Werleman, journalist and columnist, says in terms of size and orderliness, Imran Khan's so-called long march is something he has not seen in modern political history. Social media activist Hassan Mafi remarks that the U.S. is trying to do to Imran Khan what it did to Lula in Brazil, describing him as a threat to U.S. hegemony in the region. Javeria Siddiqui, wife of slain Pakistani journalist and Imran Khan's aide Arshad Sharif, demands justice for him and says he received death threats before he left the country.
You're listening to the Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to the Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
The Himalayan region of Kashmir is known for its abundant water resources, with many lakes, rivers, and glaciers. But this water has also been a source of conflict between strange neighbors, India and Pakistan, while at the same time putting the local environment and indigenous communities at the risk in the name of development. At least 7 new hydropower dams are being constructed in the region's Kishtwar district, known for its dense forests, sparking concerns amongst environmentalists, geologists, and local people who depend on the forest for their survival.
Indian authorities are currently in the process of building 7 new hydropower dams in Kishtwar, a district in Jammu and Kashmir state endowed with dense forests of deodar, pine, and fir. The dams aim to generate around 5,190 megawatts of hydroelectricity, according to local officials, but they are also likely to imperil the lives of more than 20,000 local inhabitants, predominantly members of indigenous communities who depend on the forest for sustenance and survival. The BJP government in New Delhi approved the controversial dam projects as part of its aggressive push to switch from coal to renewable energy. But environmentalists and geologists fear it will destroy the local ecosystem, endanger the lives of nomadic and farming communities, and impact the region's overall water security. The ambitious project would also see vast tracts of forest land wiped off and fertile agricultural land submerged, displacing over 20,000 people. The dams will come up on the Chenab River, one of the most complex river basins of the world, that flows into Kishtwar from the northern Indian state of Himachal Pradesh before it reaches Pakistan. So the ripple effect of this project, experts believe, will be felt beyond Kashmir, exacerbating the long-running water conflict in the region.
More than 3,300 dams have been constructed across India since the partition in 1947, displacing millions of people and fueling discontent. In particular, dams in the contested Kashmir region have long risked a major water war between India and Pakistan as they disrupt the flow of the Chenab River. In Jammu and Kashmir and nearby Himachal Pradesh together, more than two dozen hydropower projects have been planned on the river and its tributaries, including Chenab Valley, known as an active seismic zone with a history of earthquakes.
The under-construction dams in Jammu and Kashmir are likely to disrupt the ecological balance, displace people, affect marine life in the Chenab River, cause the loss of forest land, as well as heighten risks of earthquakes, considering the region's high seismicity, according to experts. One such hydropower project has already displaced thousands of people from multiple villages in Kishtwar. And the first storage project on Chenab River's largest tributary in the region is likely to submerge nearly a dozen villages and displace hundreds of families. The new dam construction also risks inflaming water politics between India and Pakistan. The two countries had in 1960 signed the Indus Water Treaty to share the waters of cross-border rivers. The treaty allowed India to build dams on rivers, including the Chenab, so long as they did not affect the flow of water to Pakistan. However, Pakistan has repeatedly accused India of causing a water crisis in the country through the construction of dams. Pakistan, for its part, has also been working on multiple dam projects on its side. Experts fear the dramatic developments following the abrogation of Kashmir's semi-autonomous status in August 2019 have heightened the risks of a major water conflict between the two neighbors, with India hastening the construction of dams.
Now, to talk more on this, we are joined by Mr. Jahangir Mohammed, the Director of Center for Muslims Affairs from Manchester. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Mohammed. Now, India is building more than half a dozen hydropower dams in Indian-administered Kashmir's Kishtwar district. So what could be its possible repercussions on the local communities?
So I think the first thing to note is that Kashmir is a disputed region under international law, and the Kashmiris have a right to self-determination. Unfortunately, India annexed and made Kashmir forcibly part of India in 2019. So the dams and the rivers should really be part of the dispute settlement for the Kashmiri people. But of course, these dams will cause immense problems for the local communities due to the potential for earthquakes and flooding in the area.
Mr. Mohammed, the Chenab Valley is considered an active seismic zone with a history of earthquakes. Now, do you think this ambitious project approved by the BJP government in New Delhi puts the lives of people at risk?
Yes, it does. Any kind of building, particularly as one of the dams is, some of the dams are in the Chenab Valley region, which is a seismic 4 zone, and in terms of earthquakes, and there is an expected earthquake sometime soon, seismologists have been predicting. So any kind of building along the fault line will have a major impact on the area and could trigger an earthquake. And if an earthquake does happen, then the lakes around it may also flood. So as well as an earthquake, you may get flooding, which will be catastrophic for the people of the valley, and which will kill thousands of people and destroy their homes. So I think what India is doing is reckless, and it is not considering the Kashmiris' interests. It's thinking of its own economic interests. And of course, there is the issue of the quality of build of dams, which in India, Pakistan and Bangladesh have not been great, and which also contribute to flooding.
Mr. Mohammed, in 1960, India and Pakistan signed the Indus Water Treaty to share the waters of cross-border rivers, including Chenab. Now, the question is, has India's dam activity violated the terms of the deal?
Yes, potentially it has, because the Indus Treaty was negotiated between Pakistan and India by the World Bank, and it's a legitimate treaty. Three of the rivers on the eastern side are supposed to be under Indian control, and three, including the Chenab, are supposed to be under the control of Pakistan. And therefore, by carrying out activity in the three rivers that are supposed to be under the control of Pakistan, they are potentially violating the agreement although they have some rights to use the water. This has to be part of the settlement. Of course, no settlement has taken place, so India has already violated not just the treaty, but the rights of the Kashmiri people, and therefore they've taken the whole region as its own property. And of course, the Hindutva ideology in power in India today considers all of the Indus rivers, and the tributaries around it as part of a historic Indic civilization and not part of Pakistan or anywhere else. So they have an ideological obsession with claiming these rivers as well. They believe it's the birthplace of Hindu civilization.
Last but not least, Mr. Mohammed, dam constructions have throughout the post-partition history of India led to popular mass protests. Now, could you help us understand why?
Well, water is a scarce, an important resource in the area. Kashmir is an area of valleys, and people live in those valleys. So any potential rebuild and development of dams can lead, especially if they're badly constructed, can lead to flooding. And in fact, the recent floods in Pakistan, India did release some water, which has contributed to that flooding in Pakistan this year. So they cause immense damage. India, of course, wants them for hydro and other electrical power. Power shortages are quite common in India and Pakistan, so this is an important resource. But also, water control can be used as a weapon of war. If India controls the Indus River and the tributaries, then basically they control the water supply that Pakistan depends on. 80% of the control of these rivers was given to Pakistan under the treaty, and therefore Pakistan will suffer, but India could either withhold water or release water, causing flooding in Pakistan, in the Kashmir area, and even drought if they stop the water. So this can also be used as a weapon of war, although if they both agree and use it in a spirit of cooperation, it can be used to develop both nations. But until a settlement of the disputed status of Kashmir takes place, the two countries will always be in a state of war, which will caused disruption in Kashmir and also in Pakistan as well.
On that note, I would like to thank Mr. Mohammed for being on the program. He's the director of Center for Muslims Affairs from Manchester. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Kashmiri multimedia journalist Safina Nabi writes that 7 new dams India is constructing in the fragile ecology of Indian-administered Kashmir will carry a high human and environmental cost. Khaled Yaqub Mir, a university researcher, notes that recent floods in the Indian state of Uttarakhand were a wake-up call for dam construction in Kashmir's Chenab Valley, where 7 new dams are coming up.
And that was our episode about the ongoing political crisis in Pakistan, made worse by the deteriorating economy as well as the construction of dams in Kashmir at the cost of the environment. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take care.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight.
G20 countries and multilateral development banks, MDBs, provided at least $55 billion per year in international public finance for oil, gas, and coal projects between 2019 to 2021, nearly twice as much as was provided for clean energy over the same period. In this regard, we have taken a look at some world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Group of 20 nations and major multilateral development banks spent nearly twice as much financing international fossil fuel projects as they did on clean energy alternatives during a recent two-year period, a report published recently by a pair of green groups revealed. According to Truthout, Oil Exchange International and Friends of the Earth US, along with dozens of collaborating climate and environmental justice groups, found that from 2019 to 2021, members of the GOP and multilateral development banks, MDBs, including the World Bank and International Monetary Fund, IMF, provided at least $55 billion per year in international market finance for oil, gas, and coal, an amount almost 2 times more than their support for clean energy, which averaged only $29 billion per year. The publication continues, this support directly counters G20 countries' commitment to align financial flows to 1.5 degrees Celsius under the Paris Agreement, as well as their 2019 commitment to phase out fossil fuel subsidies. This international public finance has an outsized impact on global energy systems because it can offer government-backed credit ratings, is often provided at below-market rates, comes with large research and technical capacity, and signals broader government priorities. Right now, the report notes, G20 countries and MDBs are overwhelmingly using their international public finance to prop up fossil fuel companies and prolong the fossil fuel era. The new report comes before the United Nations Climate Change Conference, or COP27, in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, last year. At COP26 in Glasgow, Scotland, dozens of countries and institutions, including the U.S., pledged to end public financing of fossil fuel projects by 2022 and fully prioritize a shift to clean energy investment. However, according to the new report, the U.S. has spent an average of $2.6 billion on fossil fuel investments, compared with just $358 million on renewables from 2019 to 2021. Kate DeAngelis, International Finance Program Manager at Friends of the Earth U.S., said in a statement, "As the world's largest historical contributor to climate change, the United States has a duty to show true leadership by upholding President Joe Biden's commitment to shift international public finance away from fossil fuels toward clean energy. Instead, the U.S. Export-Import Bank and U.S. International Development Finance Corporation have bankrolled tens of billions of dollars to overseas fossil fuel projects that harm communities, kill workers and community members, and cause environmental destruction," she added. She said Biden's failure to publish a comprehensive policy for international energy finance means the U.S. is breaking its promise rather than ending this deleterious financing. According to the report, export credit agencies were the worst public finance actors, providing seven times more support for fossil fuels than clean energy. Recently, The Guardian published a report that used Oil Change International's Public Finance for Energy database to detail how the U.S. government is pouring billions of dollars into fossil fuel projects in Africa, while making relatively limited investments in renewable energy. International public finance is urgently needed to build a globally just energy transition, but it cannot play this critical role if G20 countries and MDBs continue to funnel $55 billion annually into climate-wrecking fossil fuel projects. Claire Omanek, one of the new report's lead authors and Oil Change International public finance analyst, said in a statement, adding, "The climate movement will continue to hold wealthy countries accountable for their role in funding the climate crisis and demand they move first and fastest to phase out their fossil fuel production, stop funding fuels, and pay their fair share of a globally just energy transition." She added, "It is well past time that public finance dollars are spent to remedy fossil fuel colonialism by funding real solutions." Also, Euronews had an eye on this issue, writing the G20 and global development banks spent nearly twice as much financing international fossil fuel projects as they did on renewables from 2019 to 2021. The study carried out by Oil Change International and Friends of the Earth U.S. paints a damning picture of money pouring into highly polluting international projects. From 2019 to 2021, global development banks and G20 countries, including France, Germany, and Italy, provided at least $55 billion per year in international public finance for oil, gas, and coal. This astronomical figure is a 35% decrease from the 2016 to 2019 period, but nonetheless jeopardizes crucial climate pledges.
wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Armenian Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan held high-level talks in Tehran following a trilateral meeting with Russian and Azerbaijani leaders on the conflict in the Caucasus region. He was officially received by Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi on Tuesday morning, and the two held talks at the Sarabat Palace in the capital, Tehran. In addition to a bilateral meeting, the two top executive officials held a meeting of high-level delegations, and after attending the signing ceremony of a cooperation document in the field of energy, they elaborated on the results of their consultations in a joint press conference. The Iranian president stated that Pashinyan's visit to Iran will be a turning point in the development of ties between the two neighboring countries.
Neighborhood policy is one of the policies emphasized by the government, and during this administration we had several meetings with Mr. Pashinyan. In these meetings, especially in this particular meeting, the focus of the negotiations was the development of a commercial, economic and security relations between the two countries.
Expressing satisfaction with the growing trends of relations between the two countries, Raisi pointed to the diverse and numerous capacities available in Iran and Armenia, calling for an all-out effort to improve the level of relations and expand bilateral cooperation. The Iranian president pointed to energy cooperation as one of the capacities available to improve the level of relations between the two countries, saying, "The Islamic Republic is ready to expand cooperation in other economic and commercial areas, including in increasing the export of technical and engineering services." Also noting that the Caucasus region is a part of Iran's history, civilization, and culture, Raisi underscored that security and peace in the Caucasus region are very important for Iran. The Iranian president added that negotiations with Pashinyan led to the conclusion that resolving the issues of the region must occur at the hands of officials and authorities of the region, and any interference by foreigners will only create problems rather than solve them. Pashinyan, for his part, appreciated the constructive role of the Islamic Republic in the region and stressed that Iran's efforts have always been aimed at stabilizing and strengthening peace and security in the region. Pashinyan expressed gratitude for the priority given by Raisi's administration to the development of ties with the neighboring countries. The Armenian premier also called for strengthening transit cooperation between the two countries to connect the Black Sea to the Persian Gulf. Iran opened a consulate in the southern Armenian city of Kapan on October 21st, nearly a year after expressing interest in doing so. Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian officially inaugurated the consulate. At the opening ceremony, Amir Abdullahian stated that the security of Armenia and the region is Iran's security. He called for the development of north-south transportation corridor through Armenia. He also said Tehran's policies to respect territorial integrity as well as internationally recognized borders. Tehran had previously stated that changes in its borders and transit links with Armenia would be a red line that it would not tolerate being crossed. That's when Turkey and Azerbaijan have been planning to establish a new transport link called the Zangzur Corridor. In case of opening, it will affect Iran-Armenia commerce and could sever a major Iranian transit link with the South Caucasus. Meanwhile, Tehran has not contented itself with only diplomatic messages. The inauguration of the Kapan Consulate came after several days of large-scale military exercises by IRGC near Iran's borders with Azerbaijan. The latest simultaneous diplomatic and defensive moves clearly show the Iranian government is ready to defend its national interests in all seriousness.
The United States is under fire for its efforts to influence cyberspace in the country. That's according to a controversial report by The Intercept, which is based on leaked internal memos, emails and documents of the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. The work is primarily done by Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, which is a DHS sub-agency tasked with protecting critical national infrastructure. The report says the U.S. government has pressured social media platforms to, quote, shape online discourse. The platforms include Twitter and Facebook. The department has justified this pressure on social media platforms by claiming that it wants to fight, quote, disinformation. The plan stemmed from concerns around alleged Russian influence in the 2016 presidential election. It also began to take shape during the 2020 election and over efforts to shape discussions around vaccine policy during the coronavirus pandemic. But how disinformation is defined by the government has not been clearly articulated. There are now concerns that the inherently subjective nature of what could be classified as disinformation will give officials in the Department of Homeland Security a broad opening to make politically motivated determinations about what constitutes dangerous speech. This is while critics say the extent to which the DHS initiatives affect Americans' daily social feeds is unclear.
We must rethink our approach to cybersecurity. Releasing alerts, deploying incident response teams, sharing best practices are important tools. But as the pace and scale of cyber threats that we face expands, so must our response toolkit. We need sustained investment to modernize and protect our most critical federal systems, as well as state and local governments, suffering under budget constraints and increasingly aggressive ransomware operators.
The CISA's domain has gradually expanded to encompass more subjects it believes amount to critical infrastructure. Some believe CISA's goal is to make platforms more responsive to their demands. There are suggestions circulating inside the agency calling for an expansive role for the agency in, quote, shaping the information ecosystem. There are also calls within the agency to closely monitor social media platforms of all sizes, mainstream media, cable news, hyperpartisan media, talk radio, and other online resources. Critics say there is growing evidence that the legislative and executive branch officials are using social media companies to engage in censorship by surrogate. But the growing authoritarian acts by the DHS and the FBI to monitor Americans have raised alarm among civil rights activists. They say the authoritarian nature of such acts are contrary to the U.S. Privacy Act of 1974, which was legislated after the Watergate scandal that led to President Richard Nixon's resignation. The act prohibits state data collection of Americans exercising their First Amendment rights. Critics also say there are no specific legal constraints on the FBI's use of social media. Recently, Snowden sounded the alarm again, warning that the U.S. was expanding its mass espionage activities both inside the U.S. and outside the country.
Iran is remembering a historic day which has come to define its modern history. The day which has been named the Day of Fighting Imperialism falls on the 13th of Aban in the Persian calendar. It is symbolic for Iranians for a number of reasons. First, it represents the day when the founder of Iran's Islamic Republic was forced into exile years before the 1979 Islamic Revolution. On November 4, 1964, Imam Khomeini was forced to leave Iran for Turkey after he lashed at the Pahlavi regime for giving legal immunity to the U.S. forces in Iran. Before the Islamic Revolution, thousands of U.S. soldiers and military consultants were stationed in Iran because the country was seen by the U.S. as a major bulwark against what Americans described as the threat posed by the Soviet Union. The Pahlavi regime was totally dependent on the U.S. for its security needs, and it allowed its military and security apparatus to be taken over by U.S. agents. The capitulation law was criticized as a humiliation for Iranians, and Ayatollah Khomeini was among its fiercest critics. His exile was, and still is, seen by many Iranians as the capitulation of the Shah's regime before the Americans. Ayatollah Khomeini's exile stoked anti-U.S. sentiments among Iranians. The 13th of Aban is also significant for Iranians from another perspective. Shortly after the 1979 Islamic Revolution, Iranian students took over the U.S. Embassy in Tehran for its meddling in the affairs of Iran. The main reason behind the Students Act was a fear from another U.S. plot against the revolution, which toppled the U.S. puppet regime in Tehran. Over the years, the U.S. has claimed that the thorny relations between Washington and Tehran is because of the U.S. embassy takeover by Iranian students. However, this is a distorted version of history sent by the U.S. establishment. His recent remarks to Iranian students, the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyidi Khamenei, dismissed the U.S. assertion as a lie. Ayatollah Khamenei said that the starting point of the row goes back to the CIA-orchestrated coup of 1953. Ayatollah Khamenei was referring to the coup against the government of Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh, who had nationalized Iran's oil industry. The coup, which was followed by the temporary rule of CIA and MI6-approved General Fazlullah Zahedi, enabled the monarch, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi's return from exile in Italy. It also consolidated the monarch's rule for the following 26 years, until the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979, led by Imam Khomeini, which toppled the Pahlavi regime.
It was a long wait that ended in a cry of joy. Former president and left-wing candidate Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva won the second round of the Brazilian presidential election against the incumbent far-right leader Jair Bolsonaro. With 50.9% of the vote, the leader of the Workers' Party obtained a narrow victory over his opponent, who received 49.1% of the vote. The election was Brazil's most polarizing poll since its return to democracy in 1985 after a military dictatorship. It also marked the first time that the sitting president failed to win re-election. Just over 2 million votes separated the two candidates. Addressing his supporters in a speech following the announcement of his victory, the newly elected president promised to unite a divided country. The veteran leftist leader said his win is a victory for a democratic movement above the interests of parties and ideologies.
This is not my victory, nor of the Workers' Party, nor of the parties that supported me in the campaign. It is a victory of the immense democratic movement that was created beyond the political parties, individual interests and ideologies for democracy to win.
Lula made a stunning comeback while the public credited him with building an extensive social welfare program during his previous tenure in office, helping lift millions into the middle class and being in charge of a booming economy. During the election campaigns, Bolsonaro tried to shift the debate to Lula's corruption convictions in 2018, which were later overturned by the country's top court. However, he failed. Bolsonaro's popularity never exceeded 40% during his 4 years in office. He faced wide criticism over a slew of issues, including his handling of the COVID-19 pandemic, inflation, and high fuel prices. He has been widely criticized by public health experts for his failure to respond to the pandemic in a timely fashion and reluctance to introduce restrictive measures in fear of damaging the economy. Just 4 out of 10 households have access to food of adequate quality and quantity. The majority, 58.7%, live with some level of food insecurity. This is equivalent to around 125 million people. Also, large-scale deforestation of the Amazon accelerated under Bolsonaro, reaching a 15-year high in 2021. In his third term, Lula has inherited a sluggish economy, tighter budget constraints, and a more hostile legislature from the country's most right-wing government in decades. Lula has vowed a return to state-driven economic growth and social policies that helped lift millions out of poverty when he governed Brazil from 2003 to 2010. Soon after the announcement of Lula's victory in the tight runoff presidential vote, congratulations poured in. Among the list of world leaders who rushed to express their joy about Lula's victory was a long list of regional leftist leaders, including Argentina's Alberto Fernandez and Mexico's Andrés Manuel López Obrador. Lula's win is the latest example of Latin American countries choosing to dethrone incumbent parties on the right and center-right of the political spectrum. From Mexico in the north to Chile in the south, the region's political map suggests Latin America is set to see a new wave of pink tide of leftist governments that swept into power in the 1990s. The return of leftist governments in the region would bring closer cooperation across Latin America and is a clear indication of region-wide rejection of U.S. policies. Experts believe that the emergence of leftist politicians in Latin America will expand China's circle of friends in the region based on the fact that Latin America will attach more importance to political and economic cooperation with Beijing. Washington has for years backed the wrong players in the region, many educated or trained in the U.S., but Americans have turned a blind eye to the civil society's demands for change in the region, which has meant the departure of the U.S. favorite actors.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Human rights activists and supporters of free speech raise concerns about a continued crackdown on free expression in Saudi Arabia. They say people working on human rights or who express opposing views were given heavy prison sentences in the country. They added, among those arbitrarily detained, prosecuted or sentenced were human rights defenders, government critics and other political activists. We have taken at some of the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Newsweek magazine has more details. Elon Musk's purchase of Twitter has come under flak over a sizable funding a Saudi Arabian prince allocated to the American social media platform as the ultra-conservative kingdom grapples with a stark track record of human rights abuse and repression. The $44 billion deal was concluded on Friday, 28th of October, after a months-long spat between Elon Musk and the Twitter company, with the 51-year-old billionaire swiftly dismissing its CEO or chief executive officer and other top executives as part of reforms that he had already promised the internet and social media users, among them the prioritization of free speech. However, the purchase was shrouded in controversy after Saudi Arabia's Prince Al-Waleed bin Talal said he and his kingdom holding company had rolled over a combined $1.89 billion in existing Twitter shares, making them Twitter's largest shareholder after Elon Musk. Media reports underlined the SpaceX founder relied on equity from other investors to carry out the deal. The Saudi prince, Al-Waleed bin Talal, and CEO of the Kingdom Holding Company, committed $1.89 billion, equating to nearly 35 million shares in equity to help Elon Musk purchase Twitter. Elon Musk's reliance on Saudi Arabia drew harsh criticism over Riyadh's stifling of free expression and human rights violations both at home and abroad. Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman is charged with ordering the 2018 murder of dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi, who was a vocal critic of the Saudi royal family. Khashoggi was dismembered with a bone saw during a visit to the Saudi consulate building in Istanbul, Turkey. Some critics raised eyebrows at the purchase and voiced concerns about the possibility of promoting hate speech online, highlighting what they viewed as a dangerous hypocrisy in allowing Saudi royal family so much ownership of Twitter. Business Insider's Ryan Gallagher tweeted, "There's not been enough scrutiny of the fact that Elon Musk's Twitter takeover has been propped up with cash from Saudi Arabia. Twitter was previously compromised by Saudi spies who used internal data to out dissidents and have them jailed. Surprising any new owner of Twitter, especially one professing to be a free speech absolutist, would want Saudi influence anywhere near the platform." Press TV's website has also covered the same story. MSNBC host Mehdi Hassan, in reference to Elon Musk's celebration of the purchase, tweeted, "The bird is free." Mehdi Hassan, a critic of Saudi Arabia's authoritarian regime, made the post as he retweeted the news about Saudi Prince Al-Walid's stake on Twitter. Tommy Weiter, a former staffer in the Obama administration, tweeted, "The second largest investor in Twitter is Saudi Arabia. The bonesaw-loving kingdom that just sentenced a 72-year-old American man to 16 years in jail for his tweets." Saudi Arabia has long been under the international community's spotlight over its flagrant violation of human rights and continued crackdown on free expression and free speech. Saudi courts have in recent weeks sentenced several people to jail for tweeting and retweeting posts critical of the ultra-conservative regime in Riyadh. Among them were two Saudi women who have received decades-long sentences and an American citizen of Saudi Arabian origin. Ever since Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman became the de facto leader of Saudi Arabia in 2017, the kingdom has arrested hundreds of activists, bloggers, intellectuals, and others for their political activism, showing almost zero tolerance for dissent, even in the face of international condemnation. Muslim scholars have been executed and women's rights campaigners have been put behind bars and tortured as freedom of expression, association and belief continue to be denied by the kingdom's authorities. Over the past few years, Riyadh has also redefined its anti-terrorism laws to target activists. The Al Monitor news website also has covered the same story. A U.S. Democratic senator has called for a full national security review of a Saudi Arabian company's successful acquisition of a massive share in Twitter. Tweeting on Monday, 31st of October, Chris Murphy said he wanted the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States, which reviews acquisitions of American businesses by foreign buyers, to conduct an investigation into the national security implications of Saudi Arabia's purchase of Twitter. The company, owned by the Saudi Prince Al-Walid bin Talal, is 16.9% owned by Saudi Arabia's Sovereign Wealth Fund, which is chaired by Crown Prince Mohammed.